Welcome to the Learning Reinvented podcast, brought to you by myself, Katie Godden.
And James Politilo from The Learning Effect. There are lots of learning podcasts out there, so we wanted to do something slightly different. This week, after taking some breaks over the summer and back working together for the last week, we wanted to talk about some of the things that are front and centre in our minds and have caught our attention. So, Katie, what's grabbed your attention over the summer?
There's one thing to me that really stood out, which was how people are finding answers to things online. So previously, Google was kind of the number one place, but that's shifting slightly with things like TikTok and Instagram becoming ever so popular. So people are now choosing to go to TikTok and Instagram and look up reels and videos to find out information rather than using kind of more traditional online methods such as Google. But there's also that comes with this issues potentially, because is that right? Is the information correct? Who's regulating that information? So yeah, that's one of the big topics that kind of stood out to me whilst I was away on holiday.
I think it's a really interesting one, because the way that knowledge has been used over time has really changed. So we go back to sort of the dawn of time, and the only way I'd get knowledge is actually person to person, talking to people. So, you know, that knowledge was very personal. We then sort of knowledge started to be shared when we had the printing press and books. But again, it remained quite elitist at that time because not everyone could read and write. And then we've had more universal education, obviously worldwide. There's still not everyone with universal education, but things like video and audio have certainly opened up huge information sources to people as well. But we've then seen in learning a similar thing. So if I go back to the start of my career, there was very much content control, and you would take stuff in from a subject matter expert and you'd check it and make sure it's right and push it out. And it was a very controlled and channeled communication stream. And then we had user-generated content, which was sort of opening up the barriers and everyone can share everything. And now that user-generated content is just the norm. Anyone can share anything. You know, you can be a content creator from the age of 2 or 3 up till 102 or 103. And like you said, with some of the stuff coming in with AI and deep fakes and some of those things, you know, I could be Donald Trump tomorrow talking about something, and I could be someone else the week later if I wanted to be. So yeah, there's a whole, I think it's a really interesting one. And what are your takes on it?
I think there's a potential risk in people sharing content. And I think people sharing content is a great thing, because I think you're getting a different type of content out there, et cetera, et cetera. So I do believe in that. But when people are sharing stuff on absolutely every topic, they're not going to be experts in it. And we are starting to see that, because you've got things like deep fakes and stuff. And it makes you question what's real and what's not real. And that's a quite scary thing. When you are online, it's like, is it safe? Is it not safe? Is the information correct? Is it not correct? Is it regulated? So I think if it's just really mundane information that doesn't matter if it is real or not, then it's not that risky. But when it's into things that are perhaps regulated and stuff like that, and people are sharing it and you don't know why they're sharing it, are they doing it to try and cause an issue or something? You know, there's lots of questions about whether it's right or wrong. And it is. It makes it quite a scary place, I think, if you're not entirely sure whether things are correct or not correct. And it makes you kind of question what to believe or not what to believe, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I think it goes back to trust. And trust is one of those fundamental human needs. We need to trust people around us. We need to feel safe. And not having trust in information or questioning data sources or knowledge or content sources or people, or, you know, not knowing even if that person you're talking to is the person you think you're talking to, even if it's someone you know very well, you know, is quite a scary view of what might happen. And you're then into the whole question of, well, if I'm being fed by an algorithm the same information that's reinforcing particular views or pushing me and building upon quite a siloed or narrow view I might have or a belief I have, that can be quite divisive in how society develops. And interestingly, when we sort of, you touched on this topic, it took me straight back to school when I remember doing comprehension and history and things like that. And I was like, oh, how long are we going to be doing this for? And I remember the teacher saying, well, it's really need to understand the validity of these data sources. And I was thinking at the time, it just meant nothing. And I was just like, oh, yeah, fine, it's history. I've never been that interrogative of what you're looking at. But I'm looking at it now and I'm thinking for generations coming up, that ability to interrogate and validate information and check and cross-check and all of those things have got to be an innate skill set. And some people will be really good at that and some people will be absolutely clueless and even aware that they should be doing that. So I think there's a huge opportunity for, you know, organization, society, education as a whole to start empowering people with the tools to navigate through this slightly different world to the one we might have grown up in.
Yeah, because I think you've still got, you had influencers hundreds of years ago. They were just done in a different way, right? So they might have banned content, like whether it's via newspaper, books, whatever, and written their own and shared the story and the narrative that they wanted to share. But we can still have that nowadays, as much as you've got access to all the information you could ever possibly want access to, within reason, obviously. But like you said, the algorithms and stuff like that, that's feeding you to set certain bits of information based on like your likes, what you've clicked on, et cetera, et cetera. So like, is everything real? Is it not? It does really make you question those things. And you've seen it and you don't want history to repeat itself. Like you don't want to necessarily be influenced. And, you know, it does make you question a lot of things and whether it's right, I guess.
It does. And it sort of leads me into one of the things that stuck out for me over the last few months. And it's one of those things that sort of bubbles away in the back of your mind as to how trustworthy are people and how genuine are people and how caring are people and how empathic are people. And then when you roll that up into organizations, and I think this strikes for me in a couple of ways, because I just see in general society, I see almost this quite me approach when I'm out and seeing people with little regard for other people, as which I find strange because that's not where I come from. I want to put other people first, but I see people are just almost in these tunnel vision silos and don't really see anything happening with anyone else. And then I was at a couple of talks this week where people were talking about corporate responsibility and whether corporations were doing the right thing. And it led me to think that, well, corporations are just amalgamations, or teams are just amalgamations of people. And so if the value sets that people are bringing in maybe are not what you would expect, and if we're talking about, say, regulation or compliance, and we might have seen things happening over COVID or various other things where people are just looking to see how close they can go to the rules, or how they can bend the rules, or how they can get around the rules without sometimes stepping back and understanding the implications of that. And some of the talks I was at this week, people were highlighting some of the huge corporate fines in certain industries where people have chosen to break regulation with impunity because they're actually making more money than they would ever be fined. And so there's a sort of moralistic question for me as to how, as a society and how as organizations, we can bring people together who have very different core value sets and start to ensure that organizations are doing the right thing. And we've seen some very big scandals over the years of organizations that haven't done the right things. And, you know, you'll see those dramatized or documentaries around some of those organizations. And they're truly fascinating to look at how putting a collection of people together, that sometimes the vision or the drive or something else takes them to do things that they wouldn't do individually. And there's lots of psychological experiments to show how that has happened. And you only need history like times of war to show you how that happens as well. But I just think that's bleeding more into organizations as well, where we've supposedly got these generational differences of Gen Zs and whatever you're going to call them, if you believe in those generational differences, who are looking for organizations who do good and they want work to be part of their life, not their life. But are they landing in organizations that are doing good, or is we getting caught up in the mission of something that we maybe think is good and isn't actually delivering anything? And I always roll it back to, if you think about some businesses, and they'll talk about their trying to be sustainable and trying to be this and do good for society. Well, in reality, the hard truths are, for some industries, they just need to stop, because what they're doing is never going to be good. You know, having huge amounts of clothing shipped around the world, that we change clothing every day, is ultimately bad for the planet. But, you know, that you're going to see people who almost convince themselves that what they're doing is good because they're doing less harm than maybe they would be in another situation, or they're offsetting their harm. And I think it's just quite an interesting way of thinking about things, to say, are we truly making some of those hard decisions, or do we just sort of duck them because we're bought or caught up in something else?
Yeah, I think with that one, so it always kind of takes me back to kind of statements that workplaces of work have, right? So like, people might be, don't be a dick or whatever they are, you know, whatever those broad statements are that people are meant to live by. And it's always makes me question, do people actually live by those things, you know? And I think that's similar to, are companies really sustainable? Are they really believing what they're saying? Or are they doing it because they have to do it and they're forced to do it because they might have fees and stuff to pay, or taxes or whatever? Or do they genuinely want to help? And I always find with when people are saying stuff, and people are always like, yeah, I strongly believe in it, but I'm like, why do you have to talk about it so much? Like, obviously they're big important things, but surely they should happen naturally if you really genuinely care about those things. So if you want to be more sustainable, that should be at the forefront of your mind in everything that you're doing anyway, right? So you shouldn't have to keep ramming that down everyone's throats to be sustainable, because it should just be natural in their way of work. So I always find that a bit of a weird one, I guess.
And I think, you know, people might genuinely believe things and want to do it, but then there is that choice of when it starts impacting upon certain things that some of their other values or some of the other things they like or want. It's again, it's how committed are you to those things? And, you know, the other thing that's been spinning around my head, again, triggered by something that happened on holiday, but again, what that did was bring to the forefront something I'm constantly thinking about, which was sort of unintended consequences. And I was on holiday, and, you know, one of the things I love to do is dive and snorkel. And I was in Greece and I was snorkeling, and I snorkeled into this cave and looked under the water, and in front of me was a lionfish. Now, if you don't know what a lionfish is, it's a pretty, you know, scary looking animal that's, you know, it's designed to make you go away from it. It's not designed to, you know, it's not like a puppy or a bunny that you're meant to go and stroke. It's something that says,
you're not,
get out
Nemo
of my space. Yes. Now, I've, you know, done diving in various places around the world, and I've had a couple of scary run-ins with lionfish before in Thailand and a couple of other places. So I'm aware that they're not something you really want to touch, or, you know, they don't move quick, but you just don't want to be in their space. So I'm like, you know, reverse, get out. And I got out of the sea, and I was quite surprised to see a lionfish, and it sort of shows my ignorance. But I then ended up talking to a fisherman, as you do, and, you know, saying to him, oh, I saw this lionfish. And he said to me, you know, very matter-of-factly, oh, we've got hundreds of them. You know, they're everywhere. And I was quite surprised, because, you know, I'd been to Greece, as, you know, 20, 30 years ago when I was younger, and, you know, it was always safe sea, none of these types of animals, you didn't really have anything. And I was like, that surprised me. So, you know, do a bit of research and found out that actually the Mediterranean, which Greece sits in, is a sea that used to not have any of these creatures, but it's now had so many invasive creatures. And they're, you know, talking about, you know, up to 900 invasive species in the Mediterranean. And the reason that's happened is predominantly two factors, which you would never have thought about how that would have created it. And one was the creation of the Suez Canal, which is the canal that goes from the Mediterranean through to the Red Sea, brings a lot of trade through, stops ships coming from the Far East and India to Europe and the UK having to go all the way around Africa. So that's with the intention of that. So it was to improve trade, improve the economy. Ultimately, it would have done something good for the environment because it saves the number of miles that a ship's going round, but it also means it's easier, so more ships travel, and you know, you might therefore have more goods, and some of the consumer economy has been almost facilitated by building of that canal. And the second one is overall global warming, and what that means is, so they built this channel between the Red Sea, which is a very hot sea, and the Mediterranean, which was a warm sea, and that's created a passageway. But as the Mediterranean's got hotter, the creatures from the Red Sea have now migrated through the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean Sea and are now spreading out across from the east of the Med to the west of the Med. So taking that in place, what that means is that a lot of the native sea life in the Med is getting forced out by some of these invasive species. And then you think, well, you know, what does that matter? But that's, you know, a huge change to ecology, to the environment. You know, you can take it at a very superficial level and means it, you know, for some people when they're going on their holiday, they're no longer going to be eating the seafood they would have done before. And I, when I started doing some research on this, there was even suggestions that chefs in some of these countries are going to have to learn to cook lionfish if they want to keep feeding people locally, and they're going to have to change diets and stuff. And you start thinking about all of these implications, and going back to, no one would ever have thought building that canal over 100 years ago would have led to that. That wasn't a consideration, or maybe it was a consideration, we don't know. But I think about the same things in terms of COVID and, you know, lockdown and working from home and some of these things, and looking at the knock-on implications of things that are made, and you might try and think through things, but you don't always foresee what's coming. And again, that then sends me back to AI being one of those things at the moment, generative AI. And, you know, you've got lots of people talking about the foreseen consequences, or trying to, you know, futurologists trying to talk about what might come along. But yeah, it just made me take a step back and think, sometimes something that's done for a very good reason or with an intention has a completely opposite output. And maybe as people and businesses, we don't always pay enough attention to those things, or we think someone else will worry about that in the future. I'm just focusing on the here and now.
Yeah, that probably, I think, is a bit of everything that you've said, really. I think people have probably got things in their mind, but can be more disregarding of things because perhaps it is too far in the future and it doesn't necessarily impact them directly, and it won't do because they might be retiring or whatever the reason is. But I think it does make you think. And I think if you link that back to learning as well, is that not everything is set in stone and things are unpredictable, and you have to have flexibility and you have to work in that agile way. And I don't think as an industry we are the most agile or flexible. But given all of these situations and things that are happening around, that we should become more flexible and work in a more agile way in order to be able to continue to kind of keep up to speed with everything as well, and use those examples and make sure you can future proof things as much as possible, I guess, but have that flexibility in place. So future proofing doesn't mean that you have to go and buy something brand new necessarily. You can change, you can adapt, and you can still get by, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. And I think it sort of leads to some of the other big topic areas people talk about. So people talk about data, and to me, data sometimes, but again, people are quite narrow, but data is some of the way that you can predict some things that will happen, model some things that will happen, test your hypotheses, you know, iterate, build, see what's happening. You intend to achieve something, something else is happening. How can you course correct? Having something that's looking further ahead than maybe you would normally, to look at what could be the unintended consequences. And sort of the second point of that is diversity of thought. And there's lots of things around diversity, but actually not having the same set of people look at the problem. So if the Suez Canal was an engineering project solely without ecologists and environmentalists, and, you know, having that broader set of inputs to everything you do in business can start you to look in a more holistic way as to the consequences, the impact, and both positive and negatives. Not every unintended consequence is negative. There can be some really positive unintended consequences. But I think it's just a lesson back to me that we need to follow the data, experiment, iterate, and bring in broader sets of views on things, because sometimes what seems very logical to us, you can suddenly think, oh my God, I've created something over there that's a disaster, but I didn't think because I didn't engage widely enough or have a different set of people involved.
Yeah, I think you can relate that to a lot of project management as well, not necessarily just in learning. Anyone that's kind of running a project, make sure you've got your right stakeholders in the room. And like you said, it's broad enough and it's diverse enough, because without that diversity, you are just going to get siloed opinions, and everyone's going to run with something that, is it going to be the right idea? You don't know. And then obviously you're going to run into kind of implications further down the line.
Yeah, and I know we could go off and talk about lots of different things, because we're constantly having these conversations that are triggered by things we've done, people we've spoken to, things we've seen, items of the news, working with clients, whatever it happens to be. They're always sparking some of these bigger conversations and then leading down into how can we improve what we're doing, how we're working, how we're efficient, how we're looking at results, how we're improving our impact positively in everything we do. So yeah, but we're not going to do that today. But I'm really excited that when we look forward at some of the episodes that are coming up on the podcast, we're going to delve down into some really interesting subject areas and take a bit of a deeper dive on some of these broader issues that have a real impact upon the purpose and impact of learning teams and what they're really there to do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Learning Reinvented podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you've not already done so, please follow our podcast. And if The Learning Effect can help you and your organisation, please do get in touch. You can find both James and Katie on LinkedIn, and our contact details are in the show notes below.